This is Who's Talking on WCHL. Interesting dialogue with interesting people from our community. Only on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Gary Bartlett, and he's accompanied by a member of the State Board of Elections, Bob Cordell, who we might get to jump in. Gary is the executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections and came to visit us about 6 months ago and told us so much about elections, election law, and the enforcement of elections that we never didn't even come close to getting finished, and he's agreed to come back. And coincidentally, I just declare, Gary Bartlett, that you were the most publicized public official in North Carolina during the last week, that you've been in news stories almost every day about something involving elections, and it's not the same story, it's a different story every day.
It seems like that we have had a lot of things on our plate. Certainly we would like to blend in with the walls, but when duty calls, we've got to do what we need to do.
You're not the kind of guy or in the kind of business that seeks out publicity. You'd rather go through the whole election cycle and not get your name in the paper, wouldn't you?
Correct. Boring is wonderful in the elections business.
What are the main causes of this extraordinary interest and extraordinary news coverage that centers around elections, election law, and the State Board of Elections?
It seems like that the bulk of our business is related to the campaign finance division. We have lots of investigations that are at the forefront of the media and also in the process of working with enforcement agencies preparing for trial, and usually that's about 10 or 15% of our business, but lately it's been about 75%, to the point where we're overwhelmed in doing our routine work. We're at least 2 years behind in our campaign finance division because of not having sufficient staff and having just a workload. For instance, we have got to audit about over 2,000 campaign committees. By law, we're supposed to do it within 4 months of an election. And of course,
4 months after the election.
Yes, sir.
To finish it up and
yes,
be all done.
And we just don't have the manpower to do that. Another thing that we have got are inquiries or violations. If any registered voter signs a notarized statement, we must investigate a campaign finance possible violation. And currently we have about 91 items that we're looking into. Of the 91, I would say that there are about a half a dozen that are radioactive, like, for instance, the Representative Thomas Wright hearings and follow-up, and the video poker investigation. And the others are smaller, like technical violations of the law.
Or is the increased business in the campaign finance disclosure part of your business, is that resulting from an increase in noncompliance that's related to just something new in the way that people view election laws, or is it related to changes in the law that have created problems for people in doing this? Or are we just getting a bunch of lazy or corrupt political candidates who refuse to obey the law?
I think that it's not refusing to obey the law. I think that campaign finance is on every candidate's, it's very low on their list of things to do. What they want to do is they want to raise their money, they want to get their message out, and they want to get elected. When it comes time to report and disclose their contributions and expenditures, they put it off, or someone in the committee does not get the information to the treasurer. You're supposed to keep records 7 days current, and all of a sudden records have not been maintained for a three-month period, and all of a sudden memories lapse and you get a little sloppy, and that is the bulk of what we see. And then there are some that try to find that gray area and sort of build in the gray area to try to seek an advantage. And that is where a lot of our new business is coming from. It seems like that we have done a lot of investigating of issues that we are not quite sure are they a violation or not, and we have to take it to the state board. Like, for instance, a lot of 527s.
We don't have any idea what 527s are.
527s is sort of a new type of political group that is run under the auspices of the IRS that is not regulated by us, that impacts elections. They're supposed to be sort of like issue advocacy groups, and they also can have a political purpose too. And one of the reasons why this is sort of like the transitioning from soft money. You remember soft money. Soft money, we could semi-regulate. 527s, we can't. What we regulate are disclosure of political committees, parties, and candidates.
Well, let's get, you know, everybody's been reading about Jim Black, and it's kind of old news now because the federal courts and state courts have taken this off your back. But you're not through with Jim Black, are you? I mean, in the aftermath.
No, it seems like that the investigation that took over with Jim Black first started as video poker.
How do you mean video?
There was a complaint filed by video poker.
Now, wait a minute. It was filed by video
poker?
No,
excuse me. It was filed by Bob Hall of Democracy in North Carolina.
And what did the complaint say?
The complaint said that there was a lot of allegations about how the video poker industry was making illegal contributions. And we started searching there, and one of the candidates that received a lot of money from the video poker industry was Representative Jim Black. And also, we were looking at the same time with Representative Michael Decker. And what happened is that we found some information that kind of we started looking into the campaign contributions of that, and also the optometrist group, and how the deal was made for Decker to switch his party, and how the money was coming in, and that became another door that opened from the video poker industry. And then,
well, did you find that there were illegal video? Was that complaint valid, or did it just lead the investigation that led you to other things?
It led us to other things. But yes, the state board has already had a hearing on video poker and turned over its findings to the district attorney. From the Jim Black investigation, all of a sudden there is the money given by Don Beeson. That is something that we have looked into. Also,
this is the $500,000 loan.
Yes, sir.
And has that turned out to be a violation, or is it questionable, or what are the arguments for and against
that
being illegal?
I really cannot speak about that because that's an ongoing investigation that is primarily being done by the district attorney, with assistance from our campaign finance division.
If a non-candidate makes an illegal contribution, is it the Board of Elections' responsibility to investigate and discipline that non-candidate? And how would you do that?
If it was a, let's say, a political party, it would definitely be under the authority of the State Board of Elections. If it was part of a political action committee, anything that relates to the contributions and expenditures of a political committee, which is either a candidate committee or a political action committee or a party committee, is under the jurisdiction of the State Board of Elections.
So what kind of penalty would you give to the political party, or I'm just guessing that you said that you couldn't put Don Beeson in jail, or you couldn't discipline him. But
let's go away from Mr. Beeson, and let's talk about if someone or some committee violates, what does the state board have the authority to do? First of all, they could say there is not any kind of violation, and that would be the end of it. Or they could say there is a violation, but it does not warrant sending it to the district attorney or fining, so therefore we're going to have a public rebuke, and you can have a public rebuke. With consultation with the district attorney, if there is any type of illegal contribution, the state board can fine up to 3 times the amount of the legal contribution.
State board can do that by itself?
With consultation with the DA. The DA's got to sign off on it. Plus, we can get our expenses as an administrative body investigating it. And then another action that the state board can take is to terminate the active status of the committee so that they cannot take in contributions or make expenditures, or they can refer to the district attorney. They have power to subpoena and to not only subpoena people, but also to subpoena bank records. And they also have certain police powers where they can have someone arrested and serve up to 30 days in jail.
Wow. Well, Jeff Hamlin's taking care of us, and I'm checking with him if it's about time for us to take a break, and it is. I'm talking to Gary Bartlett, who's the executive director of the State Board of Elections. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Gary Bartlett. Gary is the executive director of the State Board of Elections, and he's given me a primer on elections law, and I bet you'd like to have one too, because every day that I've picked up the paper this week, there's been an article about election law at the State Board of Elections, and really, Gary Bartlett, you've been called on to give your opinion and quotes and to represent your board as executive director on all kinds of issues. One of the most interesting issues for me is the question of same-day registration, which is kind of a new, which means that the concept is that you could register and vote on the same day.
That is correct. This is not for election day. This is sort of a hybrid approach where any person who is not registered to vote and is eligible to register to vote can go to what we call one-stop absentee site. It's probably better known by most folks as early voting, and it is held at least in every county board of elections, and some of our more urban areas might have several sites. But a person that wants to become eligible to vote can go there. They can show ID that shows their current name and address. They can fill out a voter registration application, and we start the process and confirmation part of it. For instance, we must match their driver's license number or their last 4 digits of the Social Security number, and if they don't have any kind of ID like that, we have got to assign them a special number, but that must be an exact match, and if it is, they're able to vote.
So if they're able to come in and prove, it's not the toughest proof, but it's a reliable proof that they are residents of the community, then they can be registered to vote.
There are several safeguards here. First, you have the idea of the current name and address. Then you have the match of the driver's license or last 4 digits of Social Security number. Also, that person can be challenged at the one-stop site if there is a purpose in challenging that person, or again between 12 noon and 5 p.m. on election day. Once the match is done by us, we by law must send out a verification letter to that address to show that there is that person or someone living at that address. And it is done by absentee voting so that if at any part of the process it is determined that that person is not eligible, we can retrieve that ballot and not count
it. It's in an envelope somewhere with that person's name on it, so you can find it. You can find it.
It's not in an envelope. In an optical scan mark sense, it's in a machine that is marked, or if it is a direct record, there's a number attached where you can retrieve that ballot.
That particular ballot. Now, that if I go to early vote, my vote, I just fill out the, in Orange County, I fill out the optical scan card and it's put it in the machine. I don't think you could retrieve mine, could you? Or
yes, sir.
You could. If something happened to me, what if I died? Could you retrieve my vote?
Yes, sir.
And I wouldn't, that my vote wouldn't count. Somebody would have to call your attention to it.
That's correct. And you bring up a point. People who passed during the absentee one-stop and mail process sometimes do have their vote counted because we're not aware that they have passed. We have a monthly check with DHHS list, and that is how we remove a person that's deceased unless a family member brings documentation that their loved one passed away. For instance, when my mother passed away, one of the first things I did was send a death certificate to the Board of Elections office so that they could have cleaner rolls.
Well, if one of my loved ones died, I wouldn't report it unless they happened to be of the opposite political party, and then I would report it so that their vote wouldn't count. But if they were going to vote my way, I might leave it to somebody else to
protest.
That
kind of reminds me of a story. This was the 2004 elections. We do a check to see if there's any double voting or if there is any felons voting. We look for those types of discrepancies. And we found where a gentleman voted, the guy was dead, and we found out that the person who voted for the deceased person was his son, who had the same name. And one of the things that I found interesting was that the DA asked him, why did you vote for your dead father? He says, because that's how he would have voted.
Well, he did what he thought his daddy would have wanted him to, even though it was illegal. I hope he didn't have to go to jail for too long. Is same-day registration a certainty for North Carolina this year?
It is a certainty. The first elections in which that will take place is going to be our October elections, and we got about 50 of those elections that take place in October. And then we have approximately about 500 municipalities that will have elections in November. So that's the first time it will be used. And it is a good program to enfranchise someone that hopefully is not participated. And it was especially targeted to try to encourage young people from the ages of 18 to 25 to vote, because that is the group of eligible voters, potential voters, that are not participating.
Yeah, it was real interesting. Just as a sideline, in Orange County, there was a big, I don't want to call it a controversy, but there was a big worry because the one-stop voting site on the Chapel Hill campus, which had attracted many students to vote, was the Moorhead Planetarium, right, which is not going to be available. And so the local elections board had selected the Senior Citizen Center as the replacement, which is, you know, beyond walking distance from the campus. So when some of the students found out about it during the summer and fought it and brought it back, and it's going to be across the street, I think, at the post office.
Well, great.
So that it will be potentially a big drawing card for newly voting students who decide that their residence is in Chapel Hill rather than in their hometown.
I think that because of it being new and not every candidate or part, there's probably a minimum activity in parties for this municipal election cycle, that it will be a good break-in process for those who are administrating the election. I think that we're going to see how effective this program is in the presidential general election. I think that we're going to be very, very busy. The good thing is the state board has put some HAVA grant funds to help counties. We got $2.5 million that we're going to assist counties in trying to get enough staff to meet the demands of the moment.
What are the arguments against this same-day registration proposal or this new policy that we've got?
Well, first of all, the biggest argument is there's always the potential of fraud. How do you know somebody is not trying to lie or cheat? And of course, I mentioned some of the safeguard that's part of it, but the ultimate, if we catch them, they will be guilty of a Class I felony, and they may serve jail time.
So if I try to vote in the place that I used to live and then come back to Chapel Hill and vote in the place where I now live and get caught, I'd probably go to jail. Now, what are the likelihood that I get caught?
That is going to be left up to the facts and to the district attorney.
Well, what is likely that I get caught?
We catch about, every election, we catch about 12 or 13 people
who
double vote.
Double voted. I guess what I'm asking you is if I'm, like I used to live in Charlotte across the street from Bob, and if I didn't terminate my registration and went on what you call the inactive list because I wasn't voted and went back and voted in Charlotte and then came back and voted in Chapel Hill, would there be a...
We check for that after each election. How do you do that? We do a cross check of all registered voters and when they vote and how they vote, and we got a history of every time you have voted.
So that's all mechanic. That's all on the computer now.
That's correct. You can do that without.
And
we can check across county lines. For instance, when we first was able to put together a statewide voter registration system, we found a scheme by a Charlotte couple who would vote in Brunswick County for municipal elections and vote in primary and general elections in Charlotte.
They were just choosing.
They were choosing.
They figured they felt more close to the issues, of, I guess, on the normal coastal county issues.
Right. They were registered in Brunswick and registered in Mecklenburg.
Wow. Well, we got to take a break. I'm talking to Gary Bartlett, who's the executive director of the State Board of Elections. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Gary Bartlett. Gary is the executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections and has given us an education on the background of some of the issues that have been raised in the newspapers just during the last week. This is not an issue that's been raised in the last week. We're talking about the maintenance of election lists, and I'm wondering if I start a business and I want to communicate with every registered voter in North Carolina, can I come to you and... Will you give me a list of them so I can write them letters?
Yes, sir. It will cost you approximately $25.
To get a list of the millions of people?
CD. Yes, sir.
Of people in North Carolina with their names and addresses and their political affiliation. So that's something that if I get from somebody else, I'm going to have to pay not $25, but thousands,
yes,
millions
sir.
Of dollars for that kind of list. Well, I might go in the direct mail business just... with the $25 investment. Speaking of, but I guess the point is that those of us who are concerned with our privacy, if we register to vote, our name and personal data is available to anybody who can pay $25 for it.
It is public record. What is not public record is your driver's license number, your birth date number, but your name, your address, your party affiliation, your race, your sex, your voting history, those are all categories of information that we collect, and they are open to the public.
Well, I don't know why I'm doing this, but sometimes you try to track down somebody you know is in North Carolina, and you don't know where they are, and you go to the web and you search for them. But if they've registered to vote, I can use your records. I pay you $25, I guess, to get it.
But no, sir. All you have to do is go to our website and type in the name, and you will get a list of all of the people in North Carolina. What you will not get is their address. Now, if you have a birth date, you can get that address, and that is one of the protections that we're trying to to provide. Plus, if someone has been gotten a court order because of some type of stalking, their name would not be on the voter registration list.
I can't get their address unless I've got their birthday, unless I've got $25 and can buy the CD and get their address.
That would be a way I can,
I don't want to probe all of this, but if I were investigating, if I were an investigator tracking somebody down, that might be one of the first places I could go to.
There are a lot of investigators and a lot of SBI and FBI agents who do use the voter record.
So if you got something to hide, you might not want to register. You might have to give up your right to vote, I guess, if you're trying
well,
to hide.
Well, let's hope that they're not anybody trying to hide or do anything wrong.
Well, let's hope that. One of the other things that comes up in connection with this sort of new technology that enables you to have all of this information on file is the question that Bob Cordell and I, who's visiting with you, have debated this, but it's the question of what kind of ballots do we use? And there's some of us who think, just got to have a paper ballot so I can check it. And there are others who say the paper ballot is one of the most inaccurate, you know, subject to mistakes. If we just use electronic voting, that's a whole lot more reliable. And you're caught in the middle, aren't you, of these arguments? And where do you come out? What are the arguments and how do you come out?
Okay, well, first of all, we have a group of interested public and advocates who would deplete a rainforest just to keep paper. And then we have got another group of folks who believe that we should have internet voting, even though we're not quite secure in that type of tool to use. And currently we have DRE machines that has a paper backup.
That doesn't mean anything to me.
Okay.
What is a DRE machine?
A direct record. That's the touch screen where you choose your candidates, and there will be a little screen with a rolling tape that you can verify that is who you voted for. And to ensure the accuracy of the counts, the General Assembly passed a sample recount, which is done independently of the state board picking it. We've got a mathematician. In fact, it's a University of Chapel Hill professor who choose what precincts and where and how many are counted as part of our certification process of the election right before canvass. And we have had three studies, and it seems like that there are more administrative errors made by the voter with optical scan mark sense, and direct record is more accurate. Now, the problem is, before we had the paper backup, if there was an electronic mistake, you may have a failed election, and that happened in Carteret County.
Did that surprise you when it happened? Were you surprised that the election machinery broke down?
What I was surprised is that there was not any type of safeguard or mechanism in that machine. In most machines, if it cannot count a vote, it automatically shuts itself down, and this didn't. And the sad thing is that it was a programming error made by the vendor. There, for that piece of voting equipment, there were two switches, one that had a capacity to count 3,000 votes, the other 10,000, and he thought that he had put the switch to 10,000. My question is, if you had the capacity 10,000, why have the 3,000 option?
Yeah, I would have that question too.
So those were two things that were flawed with that type of equipment.
What is the result? In North Carolina, then, you can vote electronically, but you've got to have a paper backup.
That's correct. That is by law.
And is that in effect for the upcoming elections?
It has been in effect with elections since the primary of 2006.
What is the extra cost for having the paper backup? Is it costing the taxpayers a lot of money to do that?
Not really. The rolls of the paper is the only expense once you purchase the machine.
The The other thing that caused a lot of trouble or a lot of questions in North Carolina were the wide variety of machines that the local boards had the had chosen, so that it was hard to enforce uniform standards. Have you taken care of all of that now?
We now have uniform standards. In fact, one of the things that we started back as early as 2003 that we feel like that we're the only state aside from maybe Alaska or Delaware or Rhode Island where you have a small state, we have uniform procedures that's used in every polling place, no matter if you're in Currituck County or Cherokee. They are going to use the same forms. They're going to use the same procedures. And that is something that we feel like is giving us a boost in training. And if someone was to move from one county into another one, participate in elections, they would not have to start over new and learn something.
Well, one of the things that's, been in the national news, but not really so much in North Carolina news, is the race to have the earliest presidential primary. And North Carolina just hadn't gotten a start on that. Are you glad?
I can't be against an election because elections are our business. As a private citizen, I want North Carolina to be a player in the national politics. I do not want New Hampshire or Iowa deciding who's going to be my candidate on the November election. I would like to have a say.
And so you would be in favor of us getting in that race?
Yes, sir.
Now, what kind of trouble would that cause? You just have one more election to...
It would be one more election and less sleep for our directors and staff members.
And do you have
they will probably tar and feather me if they're listening to
well,
this.
Well, they're probably listening. So let me get you in more trouble. How much would it cost? How much does it cost to have that kind of election in North Carolina? Just roughly.
A standalone election for presidential that would probably be... participated much more so than our regular primary. If it was a standalone, I'd say about $8 million.
About $8 million, and would that be paid for by the state or by the local elections?
It would be by counties.
By the counties. So the state could do it for free, and the counties would have to pay for it.
The state. I think that the state needs to get more in the area of financing elections. I think that's something that the General Assembly should look at down the road.
The other thing that's sort of controversial in North Carolina is the question relating to presidential elections. Is this proposal that was talked about fairly seriously in the legislature to divide up our electoral college votes sort of on the basis of the way the election went in the different congressional districts. And were y'all thinking about when that thing had a lot of steam, were you thinking about how in the world are we going to have 13 or 14 separate presidential elections in North Carolina and count the votes? Any problems?
I don't think it would be that much of a problem. It's just a ballot coding issue and an education issue.
You mean it's no problem? Like, for instance, another thing you've been in the news about is in, I think it's in Pender County, the Court of Appeals has said you got to redistrict, and as a part of that, you'll undoubtedly have some shifts. You say it's no problem to code ballots in different precincts and different electoral voting districts. That's a real problem, isn't it?
Well, the biggest problem when it comes to redistricting and changing is placing the voter in the correct geocode. Geocode is where they live, and where they live determines what ballot they're eligible to vote. That is the hardest thing that we have got to do. But once we get that in the computer, it is a computer-generated work along with a mail-in to those folks. And it is much easier than it was 10 years ago.
I'm going to take a break, but I got a follow-up question for you. I'm talking to Gary Bartlett, who's the executive director of the Board of Elections in our state. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Gary Bartlett, who's the executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections. And Gary, we've just not even covering the waterfront. We've hardly gotten started. As I mentioned earlier, your name has been in the paper every day in the last week or two, always with a different issue, and you've been nice enough to give us the background on some of these issues. I guess what I'd like to ask you is what did they not ask you about that they should have?
What they need to ask us is, what are we doing to prepare for the 2008 presidential elections?
What are you doing to prepare for the 2008 elections?
Well, we have done something that has never been done in another state. We, by the end of this year, we've already done 77 counties. We will have audited all 100 counties, which has never been done before. So we know where their strengths and their weaknesses lie.
You mean you've given an assessment of your state, of the local board of elections and their election sort of operations, and
that,
you know,
that's correct,
what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong and how you might help them
correct
get better.
And it's about a 15-page survey, which is very in-depth, and we are taking that information, and then we're bringing groups of counties that are similar like in their issues, and we're going to do small classes leading up to 2008 elections, and we're also are giving the counties a project management software where they will know what day they're supposed to do their work and why they're doing the work, the law behind it, the policy, the rule, the law, or a court case, and we will know when they finish and complete their duty. We think that that is going to give us an edge of being better. What is hurting us now is that we have had 20 retirements or folks going on to higher paying jobs from the last 18 months out of our directors. That's 20%.
You're talking about the local directors?
Yes.
Who are moving on to other positions for one reason or another, and so you have new people that you sort of feel responsible to train.
Yes.
Now, by nature, the bulk of the election workers on election day are 1 or 2 day election workers who are temporary, and how in the world can you train them and expect reliable performance for them in this kind of, you know, complicated machine?
Let me tell you what we're doing. We have come up with a program with the community college system where we can offer courses to people in the community. This could be a precinct judge, precinct assistant, interested public, political party advocates or activist. And not only that, but we are incorporating online training where they can go to a computer, and we have even a public terminal in each county board of elections if someone doesn't have a computer, and they can take online courses. All this will be available in the next 6 to 8 months.
We've just got a minute or two left. What I'm curious about, now that you've got your respondent inquiries all over, but you know really what the real risks are to our election system and to the, what you're worried about most in terms of the possible compromises to it. What are you worried about? Where are the areas where people who would like to swing elections might go? Is it absentee ballots? Is it something else? Or is there some kind of electronic?
Absentee ballots are the most scrutinized thing in the election process. I would say that my biggest concern is ensuring that parties and counties provide the right person to do the job at the polling place on election day. I think that that we always have a struggle at getting precinct officials who have some type of ability to get the job done. That is a crucial point. As far as people trying to influence something, probably the biggest thing that I worry about is people lying about where they live.
Well, but you're not worried about politicians or people buying votes and selling votes like we did in the old days for a bottle of liquor or for a couple of dollars.
Every now and then we find a place that that happens, but for the most part, we don't see things of that nature.
Well, we really want to thank you for taking time to visit with us. We're going to ask you to come back, cover all of these things, and as the news develops about the investigations of the Charlotte legislators who haven't been able to fill out their forms, to whether or not you put them in jail or just give them a slap on the wrist.
I don't think that their activity rises to the jail level. I think that it's attention to detail is what they need.
Well, thanks. Attention to detail. That seems what Gary Bartlett is most interested in doing, and we thank him for keeping our elections as honest and clean as they possibly can be. Gary, come back to see us sometime, and thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.
Thank you.